Revenge of the 80s Kids has been rated P for podcast. There's a strange story behind that cuddly toy. It all began when I accepted a job from the mysterious Irish woman. Not much to tell about that. I got busted in a stupid argument about the colour of a boathouse. Ambushed by a coffee cup was only the half of it. My former employers were keen to show their own displeasure at the dishonesty of my CV. The German they sent broke both my legs. That was how I ended up confined to quarters for 2 months. If it hadn't been for the balcony overlooking the courtyard, I think I would have gone crazy. The doctors left me with some potted plants to take care of. Occupational therapy, they called it. They also left me a couple of robot helpers to do odd jobs. Life in a double cast would be a lot more difficult without some robotic assistance. Once I'd watered the plants and read some of my book, I was pretty bored, so I would wheel myself out on the balcony and watch the comings and goings of the other people in my block. At first, it was all pretty benign. How I laughed when someone tried to do some organic farming in their apartment. They didn't get tasty pork chops and bacon for their effort, just a pig-shaped hole all the way through their home. There was a family on first, mother, father and kid. Kid was kind of strange and pale, always talking to himself. One day he took his father into the gardens in the courtyard and they dug something up. Even from the top floor balcony I could sense that this would be trouble. Before long the father had gone on a road trip and the kid and his mother were looking miserable about the whole thing. As soon as the father had left, the atmosphere in the block became lighter and airier. Don't get me wrong, I'm not blaming him, but you see, he took the object with him. I think he was on a disposal run. I don't know what happened exactly, but it can't have been good. The father came back in a truck a few days later. He opened the back of the vehicle and over 30 people got out. They all shook the father's hand and disappeared into the city. Clearly, something had gone down, but I could only guess as to what. A few days later, another strange vehicle parked outside the block. Two guys wearing smart uniforms got out. I caught my breath, blinked and rubbed my eyes. I couldn't believe what I was seeing, but it was true. These guys were monochrome, and that could only mean one thing. They had come here from my old hometown. I was glad that all this went down only a few days before I got out of the plaster cast. As soon as I had use of my legs back, I hopped in a car and drove back to the place I never thought I'd see again. The old hometown had changed, and not for the better. Oh, sure, it was a little more colourful than I remembered, but the key theme colour was red. The streets were deserted. The place was a ghost town. I couldn't begin to guess what had happened. Signs in the store windows urged people to watch out for coloureds. It made no sense. Then a siren wailed and things began to get really dark. Monochrome miners emerged on the streets, running from something. I'd never seen a butcher with a coal scuttle on his head before. I never want to see one again. I ran through the streets and alleys of the town where I'd grown up, through madness, death and evil. I found myself at the edge of the county fairground. The heart of darkness was near now. I couldn't turn away. What a coincidence that the father of the family opposite me came from the same place as I did. If I'd discovered the source of ultimate evil in my garden, I'd probably have brought it here too. I remembered my perfect childhood here. I would have believed that no evil could taint the sanctity of my birthplace. Our nostalgic daydream had turned to an industrial nightmare. All I had to show for it was a blood-stained pink bunny rabbit. Well, you can't go to the fair without playing Hoopla, can you? Very good, Leo. Although I think you're abusing the any other business category of our meeting. But anyway, moving on to item two on our agenda. We're discussing more films based on alphabet letters today. Anyone want to start?
Well, I think Justin is going to start, but before we do, we should probably let the folks know how. Today, of course, we are tromping through P, Q, R, and S. So that means we're doing four movies each. No, it doesn't, because these shows are three movies apiece. So something's going to have to go. But we didn't want to just leave Q out in the cold to suffer and die alone. Oh, no. And we also had wanted to give an opportunity for other movies that start with other letters of the alphabet to get a second crack. So what we've done is we've designated Q a wild card zone. So that means that you could do P, R, and S, of course. That is a perfectly valid option. But you could also do Q, R, and S, where Q stands for Quotably Magnificent Movie and His Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, if that's what you wanted to do. Or you could actually have a movie starting with the letter Q, if that's what you want, but you only get three movies. I think that's fairly clear. Is anybody still behind on that? No? Good. Right. Excellent. Justin, P.
My first choice is quite a recent film, actually, and that is Paranorman. Animated film. Now, I am a huge fan of kind of stop motion animation and have loved it for years, really. I mean, probably since seeing Jason and the Argonauts and those kind of things fueled my love for it. And then obviously went on to other things and more recently, obviously Aardman and everything else. But of course, every animation style and approach has its own kind of limitations. Stop frame animation, up to recently, is not able to have maybe quite so expressive characters as traditional 2D animation, which we're also a lover of. Now, technology has enabled some fantastic things, and one of those is 3D printing, of which Paranorman demonstrates. Now, it wasn't the first, I believe, Coraline was the first to kind of use this technique, but essentially what it enables you to do is to map out the kind of characters and animate them, and you would do 2D, but then print off all of those expressions and flexibility thousands upon thousands upon thousands of times incredibly quickly, so that what you get is characters that look and act as if they are animated 2D, but they are filmed like stop frame animation with beautiful light and everything. So you have Paranorman, which is just dazzling. I mean, when I saw this, I was just taken aback. For me, this is exactly like the pinnacle of what stop frame animation can do. Because one, it's a great story. It's about this kind of boy who can talk to and see ghosts. I mean, there's a lot of things about not judging a book by its cover in this, running all the way through the characters. But essentially, there's this ancient witch that this ritual has to be performed. Otherwise, she kind of comes back to life. And, you know, there's zombies, there's ghosts. It's Tim Burton-esque, I think, would be fair to say. It's touching on a lot of things he loves, but it's a much more Technicolor affair, as you'd imagine, because it hasn't had a hand in it. Great characters. I mean, just beautiful, like jaw-dropping animation. And, you know, really good. I mean, I'm not going to give away one of the things, but there's a fantastic thing right at the end about one of the characters is just unexpected and kind of wonderful, that kind of sums up the whole point of the entire film. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of sumptuous. I say great, great kind of voice talents, great acting, great animation, and just a fantastic kind of lovely horror story with, I mean, who doesn't want kind of zombies running around and ghosts? I mean, it's just beautiful and groundbreaking and will definitely set, so from now on, you definitely, if they're off, and there will be further stop motion films coming out, they have to be affected by this because it is, you know, wow, just amazing, technically.
It's interesting that you should mention it. Have you seen Paranorman, Ian?
I haven't. The curious thing about Paranorman is if you just see like a still from the film, it looks like it's CGI graphics in a funny sort of way.
Yeah.
Obviously, stop motion is recognizable from CGI when you see it in motion. The fact that it is stop motion lends it so much charm that it wouldn't have it was just another CGI animated feature. It's a point of interest that makes you just want to watch it. The sheer joy of animation in itself. Because these days, through technology, animation is so much easier. It's almost a bit more passe about it than we were in the past, where it was a prestige project.
Absolutely. But what it will do as well is kind of make it timeless. Because stop frame mainframe animation is timeless. Like CGI dates, like 10 years later, you'll look at stuff and go, ooh, it's not looking as good because there's something else that's better.
I think that there is going to come a point. It's a bit like the old Microsoft. We've taken the diversion into a technology conversation, which I suppose is appropriate given that there's a technical feature to this thing. But Microsoft is still having a job getting some people to give away Windows XP and upgrade to the latest version. Because what happened was they hit the good enough point. Which they didn't even know existed before that point due to the fact that nothing they'd made before Windows XP was good enough. I mean, that's actually true because as soon as the new one came out, people go, oh, maybe it'll stop doing this. And they'd done it. And XP came along. And after the service packs had come out, it was like, no, this is all right. We'll use this then. Brilliant. Oh, fantastic. Cheers. So it has been ever thus for some people because they're like, well, I've got my operating system. I don't see that I should go any further. And Microsoft are like, no, you can't because of viruses and stuff. Please change it. And the reason is because XP got to a point where most users were like, I can use this. I'm happy. And I think that's the thing. We have lived at a time when the CGI animation thing has gone from, well, this is the best we can do today. And it is cutting edge. But one day there's going to be a point where it's like, well, you really can't do any more. I mean, you could. There are sort of nerdy, wonky animation expert things you could do to improve in quotes. But really, most animation is good enough. I don't know whether we're at that point yet, or whether it's just a case of we are at that point if you're a normal...
It's plateau, I feel, because definitely there was a time where you would see something, and any kind of CGI, really, and, you know, a couple of years later, you'd look at it and go, oh, that's looking a bit ropey. Well, that distance is widening, right? Good examples of any kind of animation like that, like 7 or 8 years old, and it's still looking fine. So it's getting... You know, it's getting to the point where, yes, it will be difficult. They, like you say, they will have achieved everything. It's not quite though, but it is certainly almost there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, God, how slow are they? When did Toy Story come out? What, late '90s, early 2000s? Oh, it's taking them nearly 2 decades to get their slow pokes.
Yeah. But that's something that's purely animated. I mean, when you look at things like the Mr. Smith fight from the Matrix trilogy, suddenly you get the CGI Keanu Reeves. You can really see the edit now where it switches from live action to animation, I would say.
I kind of could at the time, really. But anyway, yeah, back to Paranorman. I really like this movie and I didn't even realize it was stop motion animation when I saw it. I thought it was CG, but there we go. Because there have been some hybrid projects, of course, like Flushed Away and things like that, where they kind of go halfway through and try and do bits and bobs either way. But I think one of the crazy things about it is that not only is the technique used to make it something a bit different, but the film itself is very much something a bit different. I seem to remember it came out round about the same time as Frankenweenie. And as you say, it was Burton-esque. It took Tim Burton in that instance to school because Frankenweenie is fine, I suppose. I watched it once. I was like, well, that was okay. But Paranorman, you want to go back and watch again and again. It treads into that whole idea of making things which are traditionally associated with horror movies into something that's kind of like tchotchke-esque. You know, something you have on your desk or whatever. After Beetlejuice and around about that time, of course, we've had this explosion in actual little plastic trolls and zombies and things that people put on their desk. And I think that's due in no small part to Tim Burton. Unlike George Lucas, Tim Burton didn't have the sense to do any kind of merchandising deal for that. So he's slightly less staggeringly wealthy than perhaps he should be if he'd have boxed clever. That probably tells you Tim Burton and George Lucas not the best of friends. But there we go. Yeah, I mean, what I liked about the movie particularly is that it did keep going in odd directions that you weren't expecting it to go in. And that kind of keeps you like a ball in the air as an audience member, always readjusting your attitude and priority as to what is going to happen next in the movie. And what that means is that although at several points you could kind of go, oh, I can see where this movie is going, you would always be wrong. And that's great because it is definitely... Well, it's not that it's complex to understand. It's that it doesn't rest on its laurels. It's always trying to push you forward to something new. And it doesn't try and say, oh, well, we've got this idea for this perfectly good movie about this blah, blah, blah. Sort of it's like kids' sixth sense type of thing with a little boy who could see ghosts. So they go, but we're going to do something with this and you're not going to see it coming. So, you know what I mean? Every time you think, oh, this is this movie, then you're wrong. And then right up until the end, and then you go, ah, I enjoyed that. It was good. Ian, you've got a Q, I understand.
I do have a Q. Does no one else have a
Q? Well, I have a P. I'm going to have a P now. I'm back from having a P. It was a very quick P. No, my P is weird because, I mean, there are lots of films that start with P, and for some reason this just popped into my head. And I'm very glad that it did, because it's an unusual movie that I think may have been issued at the wrong time. I'm taking you back to the late 90s at this time, and to a film starring two people who were not very well known at the moment, one of whom was briefly spent time swinging around New York on the end of a web before sinking back into obscurity, and another of whom is now actually quite famous, that being Reese Witherspoon. And the film I'm referring to is Pleasantville. This is a very strange movie. I think, I mean, weirdly, like Paranorman, it doesn't sit where you think it's going to sit. For those unfamiliar with the premise, we live in the late 1990s, and there's this thing at the beginning that shows you how the world is going to hell in a handbasket, how young people have no future, how global warming is heating up the planet, and how everything is pretty, pre-apocalyptic. And there's a kid who's really into this show from the 50s called Pleasantville, in which William H. Macy plays a guy who comes home every day, hangs up his coat and hat, turns into the house and goes, "Hi, honey, I'm home," and his wife has made him a delicious dinner, and they have two kids, and the boy wins at the science fair, and the girl's very studious, she's going to college, and basically nothing bad ever happens in Pleasantville. The fire department rescue cats from trees, everyone has white picket fences, the basketball team never loses a match, and it's just fantastic all the time, or indeed pleasant, as in Pleasantville. We contrast this with the year of the 1990s, where the two fraternal twins, Reese Witherspoon and Tobey Maguire, are living in the traditional broken home. The mother's going off with her toy boy, leaving them to be latchkey kids. She's a bit promiscuous. He's a bit of a dork. And as the mother goes off to a weekend away with her toy boy, the siblings fall to blows over the television remote because he wants to watch the Pleasantville Marathon and enter a competition to win $1,000 for his encyclopedic knowledge of such an obscure subject. And she wants the television for some reason that is never made plain, because apparently her boyfriend is coming round. The point is, they argue over the remote, it breaks. At which point, a mysterious TV repairman comes to the door and offers to fix them good. At which point, they get zapped into the world of Pleasantville. And you think, I know where this is going. And indeed, it does sort of start off on the foot of being a sort of satire about the unrealism of television universes like Pleasantville. But then on the other side of that coin, also about things that modern people could do to make things a bit more pleasant. But then it starts pretty realistically with the teenage girl from the 90s taking, the most handsomest boy from the basketball team out to Lover's Lane and introducing him to some birds and bees, because there's a nice garden there and nature is all in bloom around Lover's Lane. At which point, this black and white world in which they found themselves, where geography consists of the geography of Pleasantville, because there's nothing outside of Pleasantville, it starts to get little swatches of colour. And this is one of the things, that kind of effect, which was first seen in the film adaptation of The Outsiders, quickly became stale in the 80s because people overused it. I mean, they absolutely came dead. Most of the picture is black and white, but here's a swatch of colour. But in this, it has an actual point in that when it's not all about kissing and holding hands and it goes a little bit further and emotions become a little bit deeper, then colour starts to come into a black and white world. But then there's an ugly side to that, because we see like the ugliness of the black and white world in the fact that the brother has a job at the burger store and his boss, played by Jeff Daniels, is often confused and somewhat lost, because unless things run exactly to the Pleasantville timetable, he doesn't know what to do. And so Bud, played by Tony McGuire, tells him, well, if I don't turn up, why don't you just do the jobs yourself until I arrive? Or, maybe I'll make the cheeseburgers instead of you, because, we don't need to just do the things that we always do. We could do something different. And this starts this ball rolling in the burger manager guy's head, to the point where he becomes an artist, gets very interested in art, and starts to paint. Well, actually, the big mistake is probably painting Bud's television mother in the nude. That kind of raises a few eyebrows, and the colour starts to flood in, and then, you know, there's violence and there's altercation between people who want things to stay pleasant and people who like the colour and rich variety of life and so on and so forth. And you think it's going to be fairly straightforward, but it never is actually straightforward. And this is where the big limitation comes in. It's a 2-hour movie, so not short, but in 2 hours, such an incredibly fascinating concept and conversation simply cannot be had properly. And so you get to this point where surely this would be better as a television series. Now, in the late 90s, saying, oh, well, I've got this script for a film, but really it should be like an HBO television series, that was madness. Whereas today, I think it's embraced as a concept and an idea. I think this is possibly why the film hasn't become more cherished, because as fascinating as it is, it remains problematic. Because as I said at one point, I turned to Sue as we were watching and go, so what we've learned is that if you have sex, then trees catch on fire, but that's okay because now the books have words in them. What? So the film in its time scale gets very muddled up. You have to read in a lot. But nevertheless, it is one of the most unusual movies that exists. And I'm very glad that I rewatched it and brought it to you here today. And in fact, it may become one of my favourites from here on out. So yeah, Pleasantville.
Well, I'm pleased you mentioned it as well, yeah. Because this is, as high concepts go, this is pretty crazy, but I love it. I love this. And I agree with what you were saying about, yes, it does, like, just when it's getting interesting, you want it to keep going. And it can't do that. The best things I love about it is the fact that when people become like aware of whatever passions are awakened in them and they become colour, then all the townspeople that are still black and white, you know, refer to them as coloureds, which is just
yes,
a fantastic kind of comment on 50s, you know, American racism. That it's like, God, why didn't anyone think of this? That's perfect, you know.
I think in the late 90s, it came across and people did criticize. I remember people criticizing it at the time. It was a little trite. I think culture has moved on to a sufficient degree that now we can take it as a multi-level joke. Because I think in the 90s, people saw it very much as, well, you can't equate it to racism. It's like, well, no, they're not equating it to racism. It's a meta joke. It's not. Yeah.
Yeah, the black and white kind of members of society are representing that kind of, you know, we'll keep our society. It touches on racism because it's like, well, we don't want people coming in and changing that and mixing that up. So we'll stick with what we know. And of course, they're all predominantly kind of white anyway. So it's drawing upon those things. But I think it's a fascinating film. Just the visual method they used. You're absolutely right. You can imagine this as a miniseries where, you know, you'd introduce a cast of characters and then gradually they would become, you know, coloured as they would each find their own passion. But then it's not black and white it's like, well, having that is not necessarily fantastic. And it's not like, well, it's much better to be black and white, because that brings, like, the film does demonstrate that having all these things does come with a negative side. Like, you know, things aren't as structured and as formal and as pleasant. They are more chaotic and more open to kind of, the darker side of emotions.
One of the big things, which is not troubling, but it reveal about the background thought process to this, is that obviously, as we said, Reese Witherspoon is your typical late 90s, 18-year-old promiscuous teen. And she goes into the world of Pleasantville, and certain people, it's not that she has sex with lots of people, it's just that she introduces the idea that they could have sex to all, and some of the other teens turn colour. And then she turns to Toby Maguire while she's still black and white and he's still black and white, says, I've had more sex than all of these people, why am I still black and white? And Toby Maguire just has to shrug, because that's what the script demands. But what it turns out is, what makes her gain her colour is that she realizes very quickly once she's introduced an entire town to the concept of being sexually liberated that she's bored with all that. And she starts like putting on her reading glasses and staying in and studying. And then she turns color. It turns out in her case that the, what was underneath all of the sort of promiscuousness was the fact that she wasn't feeling she could get anywhere. And at the end, her character arc kind of goes from, I'm not really doing anything but bonking lots of people to, well, the reason I was doing it was because in the '90s, I couldn't go to college. And she ends up staying in Pleasantville in some really weird metaphysical shenanigans because in the '50s, she can go to college. So now she's got a purpose to her life. And that is what has made her color. Tommy Maguire, on the other hand, gets a nice soppy girlfriend and goes, he stays black and white. He helps out his artist friend, still black and white. And then at one point, his television mother, who has now become color, gets victimized by some black and white youths who are being threatening towards her. And he goes up and gives one of them a jolly good biff on the nose. And the blood from the guy is red. And then it comes back to Tobey Maguire and he's gone to color. So it turns out that what he wanted to do was punch people in the face. And you're like, that's what would turn him color. And it would be, wait, what? So it shows you that the dichotomy between the pleasant black and white world and the disordered, chaotic, passionate, colored world, the color isn't always quote unquote right. It's just deeper. And that is far too complicated to talk about in 2 hours. I mean, I think it's sort of the hazard of making a thing about a fictional show. And they kind of the writer obviously got a bit geeky about it and created an entire cast of characters who would be in this fictional show. And when you create like this universe with this fictional show and all these characters and where they stood in Pleasantville society, you've accidentally created enough material for a television show, particularly when you throw in this chaotic element of awakening the color in the thing. Yep. So yes, that's where it comes down.
I think it shows there was an interesting period of kind of sexual liberation during the '90s, because here we have a young woman who's allowed to be promiscuous. And I don't think we could get that these days somehow, strangely. Would I be wrong in saying that? I don't know. It's
she's a very post-feminist character in that she starts off being promiscuous and then discovers what she really wants to do is go to college.
Yes, so but it's not that message. There's nothing laid in the plot like a big bear trap for her to walk into because of her ways. And I think it even coaches it in kind of that Christian symbolism of plucking the apple, you know. So there is all that kind of woman as temptress thing going.
Oh, the plucking the apple thing is the other way around. That's Bud's. Basically, there's a whole thing which they don't really explore where Bud gets another guy's girlfriend because he does some stuff to help out Jeff Daniels and she admires that. But in the run of the series, he knows as a Pleasantville geek, she's supposed to be with someone else, but then it's all changed anyway.
Yes.
So he runs with it and she gives him the apple.
Yes. Yes. But what I'm kind of saying is that, you know, she's allowed to be a sexual initiator whilst only being a college age student. It's completely normal. I totally agree with you, but you're not normally allowed to portray this sort of thing in the family media. It's like, surely we should be disapproving of her being like this. It is also interesting how it is, as you say, it isn't just black and white. It isn't just stuffy black and white people need to learn how to have some passion in their world. I'll be honest with you, I haven't seen the film, but I know someone who has. And when she talked to me about the film, she was talking to me about, oh, you know, in a funny sort of way, it reminds me of the Garden of Eden and the knowledge of good and evil. And, you know, it's the awakening, and suddenly we gain that potential for great evil and a potential for great good as well. It's the balance of the two things and having the free will to break out of the robotical cycle of garden tending that presumably we existed in before our liberation and damnation. It's interesting for me because it doesn't place down a simple good versus evil, right versus wrong, tradition versus modernization.
I think it does occur to me in this conversation that it is the only film I know of which is very directly the opposite polarities are a sort of order and chaos, that Pleasantville is to a certain extent too ordered. But then we are all too aware in the late 90s that chaos can be too chaotic. And it is, yes, it is about, it's a film about trying to find a balance, not about trying to go one end of the pool or the other. And I think all that does say is that basically, as it's one of the very, very few cultural artifacts that manages to, I mean, to be fair, I think that the Wachowskis would probably be spitting chips about this if they'd actually thought about it, because this is kind of something they were trying to say in the last two Matrix movies with all of their martial arts and the introduction of various philosophical gewgaws. But Pleasantville actually manages to put this case to you that they're, you know, good and evil is far too black and white a way to look at the world, and that there is more. There are more shades of colour. Good grief. This movie keeps delivering, doesn't it? But yeah, I mean, it manages to put that out. And I think another reason why people don't find it a very comfortable, oh, this is one of my favourite movies, and they buy it and they embrace it and they take it away, is because it's one of the very few movies that leaves you walking away with more questions than you walked into it with.
Well, indeed. The other thing I was going to say is, in many ways, you know, looking from a kind of moral perspective, would it be better just to leave the Pleasantville people in their Pleasantville ecosystem? They're all happy there.
Well, that is exactly one of the points that is made. And the quote unquote evil mayor, played by J.T. Walsh, does sometimes have a point. He also has the best line in the world, in the film, which is when the rain comes to Pleasantville, where it has never rained before, and the TV dad's wife has left him, and he staggers out to find his comfort and safety in the arms of his brothers inside the bowling alley. J.T. Walsh like ruminates about how terrible it is that all colored people are in, and blah blah blah, and how it's spreading everywhere, and it surmises that they are all safe in here, and that nobody's going to be fine, and then finishes off, thank God we're in a bowling alley. And it's just like, it's like, it says so much about the writer's attitude towards bowling alleys. But there we go. So yeah, that was Pleasantville. Ian, you had a cue. Tell us about your cue, Ian.
Well, it's The Pit. Hammer Horrors, Quatermass and The Pit, to be exact, 1967. And my goodness, it has everything. Quatermass, everybody, come on! Aliens, ghosts, mind control, genetic engineering, crashed spaceships, the end of civilization, riots, the devil himself, and the masterstroke setting it in the London Underground. And when it comes to Quatermass, really, for the 80s kids, the films were all we had. Most of the early series of the BBC's serial Quatermass series were live recordings. This means they filmed them and it turned up in someone's television sets, and nowhere in between was there any videotapes for anybody to wipe later on. There's only a few artifacts of those early series remaining. I believe they've done a restoration on the serial of Quatermass and The Pit now, which I'd be interested to track down since I've discovered that. Okay. But Quatermass, of course, is a bit of a British legend. The serials used to come complete with a warning at the front of them saying, don't watch these if you're of a nervous disposition. The episodes were great sort of episodic serial drama for peeling back the mystery layer by layer as the horror's grip grew stronger. And this is the kind of, you know, this film exemplifies the kind of serial that I love. And I think the Torchwood, Children of Earth, is the only modern day iteration I can really think of. Yes, so Quatermass and The Pit. Yes, as I talk about the layers of the onion. Well, first some workmen who are building a new branch line under the Devil's Hob Lane in Knightsbridge find a mysterious, strange skull. Well, you know, because they're digging a tunnel. And the area has a history for ghosts and apparitions. And then a paleontologist deduces the skull is of a large-headed dwarf man. Further excavations. Fineworks looks like a large missile object. The army are called in because it could be an exploded bomb, along with Professor Quatermass or the British Rocket Group. More fossils are found with occult pentagrams, which can be dated up to 5 million years old. The missile resists all attempts to drill into it. Ghosts are reported by hysterical soldiers. They breach the missile and find the remains of three-legged locust aliens inside. They realize these aliens have visited primitive man and engineered their own psyche attributes within man, along with their wild lust for war, for they are the Martians. The genetic trigger dormant in most men comes forth. Riots, fire, giant spectre of the Martian, devil in the sky. We are the Martians now, and if you cannot control the evil within us, there will be a second dead planet in the solar system. Warms Quatermass at the end. My goodness, there's a film.
Holy.
Yes. Mark Gatiss of League of Gentlemen, Doctor Who and Sherlock fame says of Greater Mass in the Pit, what sci-fi piece the past 50 years doesn't own Keel, the author of Quatermass, a huge debt? The ancient invasion of Quatermass in the Pit casts a huge shadow. Its brilliant blending of superstition, witchcraft, ghosts into a story of a 5-million-year-old Martian invasion is copper-bottomed genius. Interesting enough, though, the author of Quatermass hated Doctor Who because he was a man who didn't really believe that the world would be better if you made friends with green people, as Doctor Who generally does. He was from a generation who had seen two world wars and the collapse of the Empire. Doctor Who was an outsider who, with a disrespect for authority, Quatermass is authority and rightness, even if he is clashing with dim-witted other members of the establishment. I think in some ways it's a bit like Lovecraft, Kill's Horror. It's built on a vast, strange editor's trying to invade our world. Only for Keel, our world is England, and white middle-class people are normal, and everything else is to be feared. I cite, as an example of this, a later Quatermass serial from ITV. This is not a BBC one. This is one in the 70s from later, where hippies and youths who are disengaged from society are a result of malignant alien influences. Goodness, really? Well, Lovecraft was a bit of a racist, too, so by golly, I do believe through their paranoia, they've touched on a really interesting sci-fi horror trope, that feeling of we're in this enclosed bubble of normality and outside is vastness and terribleness, and they want to break in and destroy everything that we had. I think Quatermass still stands today as one of the most iconic, influential horror brands. And so, yes, Quatermass in the Pit is my thing. Gentlemen, have you seen Quatermass in the Pit?
I saw it when I was like 13 as part of a run at BBC Two. I keep coming back to these. When they did runs of actual film festivals and things on BBC Two, they did Hammer had an anniversary, and obviously it was a Hammer movie, and therefore it, and I remember being into that and being like, well, you know, most of them are like Dracula, Frankenstein, Wolfman, things like that, and then here's this weird science fiction film in the middle of it all. And I remember very clearly the crane and the shadow of the devil over London and stuff, a very striking image. I'm not sure that I entirely understood it at the time, and maybe it's worth re-examining. I have seen the recreation by Mark Gatiss, I believe. He was retained to, I think that he had something to do with it.
Yes, of one
of the Quatermass serials, which was perfectly fine, as it should be. It makes me wonder about, you know, when you lose things, and but you know that they have been lost, you have to, as a skeptic, you have to be like, are they really as good as people remember? And the answer is probably not. But as they've been lost, incontrovertibly lost, undoubtedly lost, completely lost, can't get them back, all gone, they do get to exist in this nostalgia bubble of, oh, I remember that thing, it was really good. And you don't know, you can't just go and get the DVD off your shelf and put it back in and go, oh, actually, this isn't as good as I thought it was. So, yes, but there's certainly Quatermass is fascinating, and it is a name to conjure with, and probably, you know, at some point, the cultural looters and pillagers of the modern age will come back to it. That's almost a certainty, I would say.
I think if Quatermass does come back, you just can't do kind of more of the same. I think Quatermass of its day was a kind of groundbreaking supernatural / science fiction horror serial, and you know, each series was its own distinct story, and each one would have very high stakes that built from the beginning, and there'd be so much mystery. It's one of those things like the box set syndrome. Oh, just one more episode. You really are on the edge of your seat. And, you know, because these things had so much kind of impact as being horror television, I think if Quatermass came back these days, it'd be grisly, but it would have to be a real kind of mind F experience. Of quite jarring and leaving you a little, feeling a little disturbed and unquietened after it at the end.
It's harder, isn't it? Because at that time, you know, the knowledge of the unknown was a big fear. And now people, I know there are still mysteries to unravel, but now people are a lot more knowledgeable about things and science. And it isn't so, you know, scientists aren't portrayed as kind of strange people who shouldn't dabble in things. You know, it's become much more conventional. We understand the benefits of science, And so, yeah, you'd have to really push it out. I mean, I don't think I've seen this film. I've definitely seen, the others, because I got confused when before I knew about it, because Quatermass is such an evocative name. I just thought it was the name of this creature or something, you know. It just doesn't sound like someone's surname.
Yeah, I would agree Birded Quatermass.
Quatermass in the pit. And the pit, I just imagine this like blob-like thing all crawling out of it. That was what I thought. And then, you know, and obviously it wasn't. And so the films are quite different, aren't they? Because they're each tackling a different branch of the character dealing with something. So they don't follow on at all, do they? Each of the films.
No. Each serial film is its own distinct thing.
Yeah.
It's just with
that's right. So really, I hadn't really got a grasp of Quatermass at all. It's clearly something I need to kind of catch up with. Cause say, certainly I've only seen like a couple of the films. And they don't feel anywhere near as weird and supernatural as this one. So this is clearly something I need to catch up on because I quite like the sound of it.
I think
it's fantastic, actually.
I think the pit is certainly the pinnacle of them, having knowing a bit about the other. The classic BBC trilogy is what's held up as proper Quatermass, and then there's derivations which may or may not have the original author involved afterwards. And it never seems to be the same actor twice playing Quatermass himself. Yeah, it's that creeping sense of horror. And also, I think with the pit, the masterstrokes, again, Doctor Who borrows this frequently, is making the familiar and then invading that on your television just to make it a lot more grounded. It wasn't just any old pit they were digging. It's London and it's, you know, and the Knightsbridge. And, you know, when that devil appears in the sky at the end, it's over London itself. And that is London itself rioting. And it's coming at you through your television. And it was groundbreaking for its day because no one had ever really seen drama doing that. It's always, you know, costume people, you know, having discussions or, you know, it was domestic, you know, realism. All of a sudden we're having riots in the street and there were riots going on at the time in London as well, I think. It was criticized for actually working that into the script, I think, as well. To sort of say, yes, these riots that are actually happening in your newspaper are connected to this capsule that has come from Mars, where extinct beings who worship the devil and the god of war once came from and have implanted their genes into us. And now we are the Martians.
Oh, yeah, all I say is I'm pleased you chose this because I did look at that when I was looking up Q films. And I'm like, what? Yes. I mean, I just don't know enough about to talk about anything, but I was kind of hoping someone would do. So, yeah, well done.
I also talked about this idea of the nostalgia bubble and not being able to go back and check whether your rosy recollection of this cultural nugget was actually anything like reality.
Well, I think, well, we can because they actually did, I mean, that thing with David Tennant and Mark Gatiss was a live reenactment on BBC Three, I believe. You can see them, some of the dialogue is a bit flat. The characters are a bit flat as well. So you can see how the sort of intelligence of television has evolved over the years.
But what I was actually going to say was that this is something that could not be applied to my R. Maybe we'll get through this pretty quickly. I'm going to start with this because it just links in magnificently. I picked up to watch again, and I meant to do it in the year of its release, and I had it ready to go, and then I didn't have time to watch it, so we didn't end up talking about it. And I'm going to talk about Robert De Niro and Jean Reno in Ronin.
Okay.
I remember at the time, it was kind of a weird, it's a weird film, okay? Not because it's weird, because it's really not that weird. It's an action thriller as of, you know, much 70s pedigree. But what makes it weird is that it was made in the mid to late 90s. It is kind of mannered for this. It's also weird because it has Sean Bean in it, and yet his character, as far as we know, survives the experience of being in the movie, which is a very strange thing in and of itself. What the experience I had, I think this is probably where I want to center on this, because it's impossible to describe the movie, I think, without coming into the sort of the modern era's take on it. It's a sort of a 70s style spy thriller with car chases, directed by one of the great car chase directors, John Frankenheimer. And I think this was his way of saying in the 90s when action was going the way of Big Bay, it was like, no, there's a different way to do action. And nobody listened to him, but they bloody well listened to Doug Liman when he made The Bourne Identity a few years later. And probably that was all for the best. Whereas The Bourne Identity updated that 70s action thriller thriller feeling. This stuck with it down to the choices of fonts for titles and soundtracking. I mean, it is a museum piece, even in the 90s of 70s action, which I remember people saying. And one of the things that therefore becomes most striking in this day and age, where a level of sophistication is required even for dumb action spectacle, is the fact that it struck me last night, it actually makes no damn sense whatsoever at all, even on a pretty basic level. At the beginning, Robert De Niro and a group of shady ex-intelligence agency types, in a way where it's like the writer has read sort of Jean Le Carré, but then also enjoys watching James Bond movies and The French Connection, is trying to meld those two actually pretty fundamentally incompatible types of thriller together. And they all get together in a warehouse and they've got to get a case which has a MacGuffin in it. So then there's a Hitchcock kind of reference in there. And then some stuff happens. And then basically about halfway through the movie's runtime, they do the big car chase where they get the case. And then it turns out that it was a setup. But the thing about it is Robert De Niro's character, Sam, who throughout it is all like, I'm just here to get paid and do whatever and do what have you. At the point where they do the job, and this is the thing where it almost has a triumph, is that Robert De Niro's character is very much, he treats the whole thing as a job. And so the conversations they have are like, well, I'm going to need this kind of grenade launcher. And the director is obviously saying to them, you have to be talking about this the same way that if you were a construction crew, you're going to, well, we'll need this kind of drill bit to get through the rock and blah, blah, blah. And here's the geological survey. You're talking about it as if it's just a thing that you are doing, but that thing happens to be espionage, spycraft, and staging things and misdirection and what have you. Sean Bean's character exists entirely to show the contrast to this, that he's just some chancer and he gets terribly overexcited about everything and is far too blunt and has no spycraft whatsoever, and they rumble him as an imposter and send him off into the night by himself. But then later on in the film, after they've been sold out, you instantly, on this day and age, and we think, wait a second, these guys are just doing this to get paid. Okay, so they did what they were supposed to do, and it turned out that things weren't exactly what they were supposed to be. But if you were a tradesman, you said, well, you paid me to do this job on this day. We retrieved the case. The case happened to have a bomb in it. But we've still done the job. Where's our money? I'm off. Instead of which, they go into this incredibly protracted further sequence of shooting, shooty scenes and car chases until they get to the end. At which point it's revealed to no one who is actually watching in the modern era, because you're like, you spend literally 45 minutes going, yeah, but all the way through they've built up this very important feature. They didn't have a scene where they said, well, we're done now, can I have my money, we'll go again, but we didn't get the thing we wanted. They switched out the case. Well, that's not my problem. You paid me to do this. I'm going to do this. They never have a negotiation for further money. He seems to do it because he's irritated at Stellan Skarsgård, who makes a fairly anemic villain, because all the time they could have done to set him up as a traitor and a villain, they were instead showing you Sean Bean getting overexcited about things, which is a complete error of judgment, because you've only got so much time in a film, and really you're like, oh, really, that guy's the traitor? Well, I guess I didn't see that coming, despite the fact it's Stellan Skarsgård, due to the fact that they've had no time to introduce him as a character, because they've been too busy watching Sean Bean jumping about doing a Yorkshire accent. At which point, you spend all this time building up this idiot, and then you go, yeah, that's it, your part in the movie's over, bye, and he goes out a door. Would you not have been better served spending time instead ditching that whole redundant plotline? Because, hey, we get it. They approach it like a job. We don't need a counterexample to understand that. It would be better if it was like a three-way friendship where the three of them were very involved in planning the operation. So it's Stellan Skarsgård, Jean Reno, and Robert De Niro. And then they pull it off, and it turns out Stellan Skarsgård's a traitor. Even if you saw it coming, at least you'd have the character to hold on to. But you don't get that. And then you don't understand why Jean Reno, you don't understand really why Jean Reno does anything, but Jean Reno brings the acting chops to this in that he has the most wonderful Gallic shrug. He doesn't actually have to shrug. That's how Gallic it is. He's just very present. Is why are you doing this? He's like, I don't know. It seems like something to do. I get to shoot people, you know, eh? And that's fine. You understand that. And Robert De Niro, by the way, is a puzzle. You're like, why is he doing any of this? The only reason why he would possibly still be pursuing whatever's in this stupid suitcase is if he isn't actually, oh, yes, he never left the CIA. He's actually a deep cover operative pretending to be a mercenary, and he has to get the case because he's not going to give it. Oh, in fact, the case was, he says specifically then, the case was never at issue. It was the man who wanted the case, played by Jonathan Pryce, possibly the world's least convincing Irish terrorist. I mean, he does the Irish accent and he is an actor, but you just look at him going, oh, Jonathan, you're about as evil as a cucumber sandwich. Stop it. And at the end, he shoots Jonathan Pryce and then everybody goes home. You know, if you contrast it to things like Bad Boys, The Rock, you start to think things like, well, compared to those, it is stylish. It has really good car chases. It's where, I mean, it makes as much sense as those. But in the modern era, this just doesn't cut the mustard. And so in my head, I was going to come here and talk about Ronin, the stylish action thriller of the late 90s, which brought some old school virtuosity into a world that at the time was just filled with slow motion American flags and helicopters with their blades wearing, and that they showed you some gritty. I mean, all the car chases are done with proper cars. There's no CG. John Frankenheimer wouldn't be having any of that. It uses all of the tricks from the French Connection. Those are great. But the actual film itself is very transparently a very shoddily constructed frame on which to hang three great car chases. So, you know, it kind of diminishes it in reverse. Gentlemen, I give you the poorly aging Ronin for your consideration.
I have seen this movie. I saw it in the cinema as well. I think my dad wanted to go see it, so I went and saw it with him when he was on holiday or something. Yes, of course, it's Ronin because he's supposed to be, he's masterless now because he's left the CIA. So that was the conceit. And of course, we're never going to tell you what the MacGuffin is in the suitcase. We're never going to tell you, but let me just say, after resolution of the suitcase malarkey, peace broke out in Northern Ireland. Just saying. Yes, I have to say, I do enjoy watching a film about professionals getting on with a job. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's the man inside me. He just likes tools and doing things. I don't know. But it's nice when there's no jerks. There's not much in the way of Sean Bean is, you know, who's transparently a fool. It's just a matter of time until they've got enough evidence they can kick him out of the group. But by and large, it's professionals getting on with a job. Issues not arising out of personality clashes or people having bullshit or doing stupid things. They come out of the things they have to deal with to get the job done. And of course, then we have the switch around. Of course, it's the MacGuffin is, yeah, they go get MacGuffin. MacGuffin gets taken by somebody else. They go get the MacGuffin back again. I mean, there's your plot right there. But you know, the fact they just go about it and they're professional. And like, there is disrespect between
Jean Reno.
And God, now
Robert De Niro.
Yeah. And so that's kind of nice. It's nice when you have professionals respecting each other and getting on with the job and doing it well. And neither of them superhuman, incidentally.
I'm not arguing certain bits of it.
Yeah, I wasn't critical. I mean, I think it's true. It probably is aging badly. But I think, you know, as a kind of throwback to 70s, maybe the 90s, it probably should be aging badly. But I appreciated it for what it was. And certainly I haven't seen it again since. And yes, it is quite memorable, Sean Bean getting kicked out of the movie halfway in. He's literally shown the door. Go on.
Yes,
get out of here.
Very, very much. I mean, yeah, Robert De Niro gets some good lines and some pretty creaky lines. I think the most memorable line in the film is the one that cruises the line between terrible and good. It's like, is it so terrible it's good? Is it pretty good, but it has an underlying seam of terribleness? It's a bit where it's like he says something along the lines of, you can't even remember the beginning of it. It's like, always watch the exits. That's the first thing they teach you. Jean Reno turns to him, and who are they? I don't remember. That's the second thing they teach you. And at which point, anyone who's watching it on a DVD has someone in the room go, wait a second, so what you're saying is, it's like if I was doing a maths class and then I solved the quadratic equation, I said, that's the first thing they taught me. Who taught you? I don't know. My teacher taught me to forget who they were. It's like, it doesn't make any sense. What is that about? Having reiterated it here, it is a line that is so bad, it's actually genius. possibly not the best thing to pick. But there's a lot of this where Robert De Niro just talks about things or does things. The bit where he ambushes Sean Bean with a cup of coffee is on the other side of that. It's brilliant. So yeah, the film is uneven in its, you know, it has good scenes, it has bad scenes. And I think what makes it age badly is that I think these days people will make a bad movie that's consistently bad, like Sharknado, or they'll make a movie that has a sufficient quality to get past a certain bar. No longer do we make a movie where certain parts are really good, because what we've learned is that if certain parts are really good and other parts are mind-crunchingly terrible, the mind-crunchingly terrible bits actually drag all the good bits into a morass of hate and despair. So at least if the whole thing is in that morass, like a Transformers sequel, then it's all of a similar level. So it's homogenous. I think we want more homogeneity in movies these days. And Ronan is not homogenous. So, Justin, you have an R. What R do you have for us?
Well, now, you mentioned Hitchcock. I thought it was about time. I've dealt with Hitchcock before, but not directly. I thought it was about time. So I will choose one of my favourite Hitchcock film, and that is Rear Window. The setup is brilliant. The central character is in a wheelchair. He's a photographer. This is James Stewart. And he has an accident, and he is now confined with his leg in plaster to just sit in his apartment, essentially. He's fortunately, he kind of lives in this block where there's good view of, I mean, it's an incredible set, of all of his neighbours, all of them who like to leave their, you know, they don't believe in kind of closing the curtains at all. So he has this vast tapestry of life that he spends the first part of the film. It's a nice summer, it's hot, and he doesn't really know these people that well, so he gives them nicknames, and he watches them play out their little lives, almost like he's watching kind of TV. As he kind of glances from window to window. So, you know, there's different kind of stories being played, and there's kind of like a couple in love. There's a sculpture, there's a dancer. So he kind of watches all this, and he's enjoying the kind of the voyeurism of this. And then one of the neighbors he sees, he begins to get suspicious of this kind of husband and wife. I think they're having rows. And then the next minute, you know, he sees him kind of carrying this enormous case out of his apartment. And there doesn't seem to be any sign of the wife. So he then begins to kind of voice his concerns to Grace Kelly, kind of archetypal, kind of Hitchcock blonde, really, I would say. In his mind, he's picturing this kind of thing. So anyway, he's determined to find out. But here's the thing. The entire thing, pretty much everything happens just from the perspective of the main character. We do not leave the apartment. Everything we see just from the window, looking sometimes with the camera, zooming up on things. So there's this kind of distraction when he's not capable of doing anything other than send people out. It's what he does. He's got a nurse and he's got Grace to investigate. But he is himself kind of just physically unable to do anything. And therefore he just has to sit and watch. So of course now what happens is Raymond Burr, who plays the husband, he's clearly up to no good, but they're trying to work out what's going on. So, you know, at one point a dog dies and then James Stewart believes that, well, he must have maybe buried the body in the garden. So they send them down there and no, there's nothing there. And then finally, Grace Kelly goes to the apartment to kind of check it out. And of course he confronts the husband, kind of comes back and, you know, you're seeing this kind of tension. He calls the police. She then signals that she's found a wedding ring that he's kind of zooming up on. And so, incredible kind of levels of story you're picking up, all these little details just from this position. And then, of course, finally, you know, the guy realizes, works out what's going on, and he confronts him. And he actually comes to the apartment. So, obviously, then you're kind of helpless. And there's a fantastic fight sequence with James Stewart. You know, the only way he can possibly deal with this is just literally firing off his gun on his camera to kind of stun Raymond Burr. And in the end, you know, I mean, he ends up kind of falling off the balcony and having two legs in plaster at the end of the film. I mean, it's like so tense. You know, you want to run up and run away from the situation or go over there or do something. You can't. Everything you're seeing is just through the windows. All of these kind of see things played out. It's beautiful. It's kind of, it's dramatic. You know, Hitchcock has done this before with a very constricted kind of put these limitations on characters or situations he's done before. But here, everything kind of comes together. You know, you're kind of rooted to this spot. helpless, but also you're frustrated and tense. And of course, when the final kind of thing, when Rambo comes, and I mean, you know, you really feel for the character. I mean, what realistically can the guy do? He's sat in a wheelchair with his leg in plaster. So yeah, it's, you know, perfect. I mean, I'm a big Hitchcock fan, but I mean, this something, you know, there was something special happened with that. Just these little, you know, this framing mechanism, just seeing the world laid out and the kind of thing, because it's everyone, people watches. So you can imagine this guy just seeing these little frames alive. And what would you do if you were watching everyone go about their business and suddenly something was a bit odd and strange that you weren't really in a position to do much about it other than tell the police and they might just think you're an idiot for assuming sort of thing. So yes, Rear Window.
Is a darn fine thriller. It's been remade numerous times. And indeed, the beginning of the film is lovely because it is a massive set with all the, you know, he's looking out on the yard against all the sort of little miniature dramas that play out before him. And he talks over them like a god looking down on them. And, you know, all these lives and all these characters that populate the world. It's very clever because at the end of the day, he's just stuck in his room. I mean, it's almost a stage play. He's stuck in his apartment. He's in a wheelchair with a broken leg. What's he going to do? And it's a great kind of reverse take on a murder mystery. We know who the victim is, we know who the murderer is, but we've got no way of proving it other than our accusation and a few funny things we've seen that have led us to this conclusion. Like, how did you go about? Because I believe he starts trying to trick him and harass him. He rings up and goes, I know what you've done, and things like that. They try and force him into performing certain things that would incriminate him.
So we can see his response when he picks up the phone. This is just brilliant, right? Considering what's happening in this set, at one point he gets Grace Kelly to kind of lure him away so that he can get someone else to go in there or something. But you see all that because, you know, just past these buildings, there's a gap and you can see a bar across the road, you know, so you can see all of that happening, just from this vantage point. I mean, it's, yeah, amazing.
Yes, well, as you said, it's been remade numerous times, but in addition to being actually remade, it's also they've been a victim of update fever. They've always gone, oh, Rear Window, that's a brilliant movie, isn't it? What if we updated it? And it's unusual because here we are in the middle of the alphabet, and yet suddenly we hear a certain noise. What's that noise that we hear? Shia LaBeouf noise, unfortunately, because they made a film a couple of years ago called Disturbia, starring Mr. LaBeouf, and in that he's under house arrest, and he believes that his neighbours are up to no good, but he can't leave the perimeter of his house because he's been doing something, you know, like the Ute do because adults don't understand or something, or just because placing Shia LaBeouf under house arrest sounds like a jolly good idea. If we could get Justin Bieber and put him in with them, maybe they could have some kind of Thunderdome-like battle to the death, and then we'd only have one annoying thing to deal with instead of two. But anyway, I'm digressing. Yeah, so they did that. And they also, of course, the other famous attempt to update the idea of Rear Window with what could be termed as spectacularly off.
Oh, I know what you're
going to say. It's the 1990s movie Sliver, in which we turn it into all about Sharon Stone having a nice time in the bath and someone watching like all of the cameras on a high rise. The point about it is that film students and those who write essays for film students will bang on about Rear Window and its idea of undermining the sort of voyeuristic nature of film and the relationship between the viewer and doing all of these things. And although all of this is true, it does actually expose the genius of Hitchcock that people, although it's fairly easy to grasp what people are on about, actually doing it as a film turns out to be incredibly difficult because people fail to do it consistently and all the time.
Well, the thing about Hitchcock, of course, was that he was a meticulous planner. He loved planning movies. So I think, you know, he had all this worked out and storyboarded in his head before he even, you know, set off to start shooting this thing.
The other thing about planning, as you know, Ian, is that it means that if you are a meticulous planner, you will spot all the stupid, goofy things that you could do with a plot before they come up, so they don't come up, which is something that cannot be said of the people who wrote Disturbia or indeed Sliver.
There was also another one starring a TV movie starring Christopher Reeve.
Yes, of course.
Oh, that was terrible.
Yes, but, well, it was a bit...
I mean, it's like, oh, pal, you're now quadriplegic. hey, I've got a role for you. That's not a good thing.
Well, of course, at the end, the murderer comes in and turns off his ventilator, and he was genuinely gasping. That was a bit uncomfortable. He said, feeling the discomfort in the room.
There was, in fact, a lot of discomfort in the room. So, yeah, interestingly, Justin, we can't obviously do this now unless I'm about to tread on Ian's toes. When you said a Hitchcock movie, one of your favourites, beginning with R, I, of course, thought of Rope, which is actually my favourite Hitchcock movie, but it didn't pop into my head to talk about it. Instead, I talked about a disappointing film with...
I was going to mention Rope, because Rope has a similar constraint in terms of it all being set in the same room. So this is kind of Hitchcock's, I guess, he's he kind of loves kind of plays and using that kind of thing in films. But yeah, that's a very, obviously a great film as well.
Yeah. So that is Rear Window. So, Ian, what's been happening on your television window in regards to your R, he said, with a segue that is so clumsy it might have come out of Ronin.
I can see the movie pitch for my R now. Hey, how about we do Jaws, but set in Australia? Well, that could work, you know. They've got sharks in Australia, lots of nice beaches. No. It's in the outback. Oh, there's no sharks in the outback. There's no water. Exactly.
Oh, I know.
Instead of a shark, we'll have a pig. Huh? Gentlemen, I give you Razorback. Yes. Finding your wife's wedding ring in a pile of hog shit is no way to find out what happened to her. It sounds silly, and I suppose it is, but for a film about a killer pig in the Australian outback, it's darn fine. 1984 Australian film, for its low budget, it's technically well shot and makes good use of suspense, like Jaws does. It doesn't linger on the pig Muppet too long. It opens with a man, Bill Kerr, failing to defend his home from a thunderous assault from the titular pig, which blazes through his wooden home like a bull, stealing his grandson and burning the house down. He stands trial, is vilified, but escapes prison due to lack of evidence, but vows vengeance 2 years later. Later, cut to the States for imported American actors. Here comes Judy Morris, TV reporter, says a sudden romantic goodbye to her domesticated husband on the anniversary as she goes off to Oz to cover the gripping story of hunted Australian wildlife. Now, in Australia, she walks into a rustic bar with a cameraman, silence, she asks to interview any kangaroo shooters, gets laughed out of the building, and yeah, this is all about the roos being hunted to extinction, which as an Australian, I find that hilarious, that kangaroos could go extinct. Anyway, she's out of her depth and unable to contact New York, and everyone treats her as daft, which she is. So then she tries sneaking up to an illegal abattoir with sinister music playing. So she gets spotted and immediately runs away. So naturally up against this feeble reporter, the only natural response is to try and murder her by running her car off the road at night and trying to rape her. Good news, a razorback turns up and chases off the hillbillies. Bad news, then it eats her. So we start the film all over again. This time, when no body is found, they assume she fell down a mineshaft, and her husband turns up from America, played by Chris Hayward, to find the answers. And so here we have our dynamic, a large and helpful group of locals and roo-hunting enthusiasts, some of them operating in an illegal cannery with the willingness to murder any outsiders who threaten it, along with dangerous local wildlife of boars who are being whipped into a frenzy by something set in the backdrop of Australia's harsh environment, with only one or two sympathetic characters about, one of them being Bill Kerr, who is now adapted his truck into a hog-hunting behemoth. Threat really lets up in this monstrous tale with Evil Hicks that culminates in a showdown at a local meat processing factory where all throat pleads collide along with the appropriate hog-grinding mincing industrial grinder. The director of this was Russell Mulcahy.
Mulcahy.
Let's all say it again, everybody. Who was, you know, leading music video director in the world at the time. And he wanted to be doing a feature, but he kept getting off musicals. Finally, he gets offered to do Razorback. He leaps at it. And here we are. It was mostly shot in Broken Hill, which I think is too far away from me. The Australian Cinematic Society said it gave it the award for best cinematography and best acting that year. Yes, it also won a cinematography award as well. So it looks great. Beautiful shot. Low budget. Never lets up. Thumping good, chased around by a giant pig in the Australian outback, monster movie. Go.
I've seen the opening scene, which is kind of cartoonish in a way, when the thing, like the hole appears in the house. Like,
yes.
Bump! You know, there's rumbling in the night, and then suddenly, whoosh!
Yes.
Noisy.
It is a genuinely huge, big, monstrous boar. Yes, it's utterly ridiculous. So, yeah. You're quite right, but it's like, I've explained the setup. It's going to be ridiculous from the onset. Its genes are ridiculous. But for what it is, I thought it was quite good.
I think there is a thing in which there's two levels of ridiculous, though. There's the level of ridiculous of Sharknado and Black Sheep, the one with the genetically altered sheep, where they're actually obviously trying to take the piss. Whereas Razorback, I think where we really have an opportunity is when it dances the line between, are they kidding or I'm not sure. You know that they're kidding in Sharknado. You know that they're kidding in Black Sheep. It's like the people making the film are turning around and giving you a big wink. With Razorback, there's that thing of like, no, seriously, this is really awful and dangerous. No, really. And then they wink at you and you're like, oh, you're joking. And I go, no, I'm not joking. This could really happen and it's terrible. No, really, it's a big pig. Yeah, yeah, I know, it's ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah, but they can get pretty big, you know. It's that level of toying with the audience about, are they joking or not? That's where you want to hit. And sorry, genetically engineered quasi-zombie sheep is not a way to go. Not that I've actually seen Black Sheep. Might be terrifying, I don't know.
I've seen that, but I haven't seen Ray. So I can't comment, although I feel I should investigate now.
I feel I have now finally presented a film neither of you have seen, and it is a glorious yes. feeling to behold, can I just say. I saw this, a friend of mine had the, because it did get a limited release, but it was pretty much a straight to video film for everyone else. I think he rented it out and went around his place to watch it. And afterwards I was come out thinking, yeah, I want to see lots of genres now of different animals attacking and it'd be great and everything. Little did I realize this was actually a thing that was going on. So it left me suitably impressed at the time.
Indeed. So there we go. Razorback killer pigs coming at you. Justin, you had better get your S because soon you will not be joining us any further. So, so let us hear what S you have in the bag.
Well, now this is a bit of a change from that. I'm talking about this film because I find it very difficult to talk about it like as a film, like, oh wow, yeah, that was a good, I enjoyed that film. Because it's more something that is an important film to watch, and that is Schindler's List. There's very, very few films I would say is important that everyone should watch this film, and pretty much, you know, Schindler's is up there in that list of, you know, one or two kind of things. It's also a very important film for Spielberg, really, because this is a film where Spielberg, for years, he didn't think he was capable of doing it, and actually passed the script around to a number of much more kind of notable directors. But in the end, thankfully, I mean, he decided to do it. Since then, you know, we've seen plenty more kind of political or more grown up, let's say, Spielberg films. But up to this point, you know, we just had Jurassic Park, right? And so Spielberg was very much in his mode that we're all familiar with, kind of family, kind of light, upbeat, kind of films. And then we have this, which, you know, it's not going to be a typical Spielberg film, obviously, from the subject matter. But my God, I mean, obviously anything dealing with the Holocaust is going to be powerful. It's going to be upsetting. But he doesn't hold back in this, which is what you know, I remember people going along thinking, is he going to kind of schmaltzify it? Is it, you know, he shoots it in a kind of documentary style. He didn't storyboard it. It's black and white. And that's important. You know, he kind of talks about, you know, color being kind of life, you know, and therefore how could that possibly be part of anything based on the Holocaust? So it's striking for that. It doesn't hold back. It seems like it's going on forever. I think it's about 15 minute sequence where they're basically the Nazis are just systematically killing people in a ghetto. The thing that shocked me about it is like, it's so just matter of fact. Shoot a gun, dead. Like there is, you don't even, it's so shocking that you don't, I mean, you don't have a chance to even form anything about these people because in a second they're introduced, you know, a second later they are just dead. And it keeps going on. And it's like, oh my God, this is, obviously this is touching on, you know, this compared to obviously what's actually happening is minute in terms of emotion and everything else. But my God, does it work on that screen? It's obviously kind of a stellar cast. John Williams music again, but John Williams again, this is grown up kind of, you know, this music is not the kind of soundscape that John Williams normally does. You know, you could arguably say that he's kind of doing kind of half the film you know, certainly with Spielberg things, because of the kind of motion put into it, it's very subtle. You're not going to get like a big orchestra kind of playing out these scenes. It's very poignant and obviously kind of emotional, as is appropriate. And again, you know, there's like some techniques in there that Spielberg tones down his kind of thing. It's very realistic, but he uses color very importantly. Like there's a bit of color at the beginning and a little bit at the end. And then obviously you've got the kind of red dress of the girl is kind of killed in it. These all things are kind of symbolic. There's very reasons why he's doing that. And obviously the color at the beginning and the end is kind of meant to be, you know, the life being diminished and then obviously hope at the end. Obviously intense and powerful. I came out of that. I've only seen it once. I don't think I could watch it again, quite frankly. It was rather traumatic, as I imagine it would have been for a lot of people. It pretty much said everything that I ever want to see depicted about that subject. And then I just went, wow, okay, that's an important film. People need to see this. At the time, I believe the reason that Spielberg was keen to make it because there was a lot of people, Holocaust deniers, that was the thing that was happening. So that was the thing that spurred him into going, right, this is going, I'm not going to allow that to happen. So this is going to be mainstream America, have this film and there, you know, think about it. It's a very important film, but I find it difficult to talk about in terms of a film like, well, you know, that's a fantastic kind of mise en scène and fantastic, you know, because it's kind of not really about that at all. You know, it's about, it's showing reference to something obviously deeply kind of ingrained into a vast kind of way of people. So it's incredibly respectable for that. And it's just, you know, as in terms of cinema, this is really what cinema should be. You know, you should, as well as the fluff and the fun, and we all talk about geeky stuff all the time, you know, and obviously that's great. And they're most of the films I want to see, but cinema should also do stuff like this. It should give you an insight for something that you can't possibly imagine unless you've experienced it. But it can give you enough of an insight that is chillingly close to kind of, you know, take note and take heed. And, you know, pray to God that nothing on that scale of that like ever happens again.
The thing I like to focus on, well, two things. Firstly, do you think it's really appropriate to focus on a film about Jews just after I do a film about pigs? Seriously, Justin? The other thing I want to talk about is really just how everyone in this is human. And I think that is another very important thing you've got to establish about the Holocaust. Because as soon as we say, oh, well, they were monsters, to excuse their behavior because monsters eat people. No, these were humans. These were civilized people. This was the 20th century. And my goodness, this actually happened. And the bizarre thing about Holocaust deniers is they're kind of saying, oh, no, it wasn't 7 million Jews. It was about 4 million Jews. It's like, you're missing the point. 4 million Jews is still 4 million too many. Those meetings were documented. We know they happened. They know they commissioned extermination. I don't care if they killed one person. It was still a crime against humanity. It's this strange disconnect they have. The other Jews are pushing the numbers for sympathy. Well, there's a definite grievance here, whether it's 4 million or 7 million. I don't ever quite got that. But yes, it is the humanizing, even the despicable kind of, you know, oh, what's his name? The guy who runs the camp. Even he, a flawed, nasty creature that he is shown to have a kind of weakness. And even though he's committed to this evil he's doing and wants to show no humanity towards the Jews whatsoever, he's still human himself. He's still a believable person. He's not just a black and white villain, even though everything he does is evil. And for me, that was like the very important thing. Also, Oscar Schindler himself is no black and white hero. He had definite flaws to him as well.
Yeah, I think it's a redemption.
Yeah, he definitely did start out going, well, I've got an exploitable workforce here now. He just gains sympathy for them later. He did at the margins exploit his power slightly he had over them. But generally speaking, by the end, he was simply a crusader. It's like, you know, that whole thing at the end where they melt down the gold from their teeth and give him a ring or something. And he's like, I could have solved this and saved some more people. It is the triumph of humanity. Then this thing was done. It was done by humans, but it was this kind of the human nature revolts against it. Said, no, actually, this is not cool. This isn't okay. We're not going to get over this. This has to stop. Very, very worthy film. It's almost criticism proof, I think, totally, because it's a subject matter on how it deals with it. So, Leo, your thoughts?
Well, one, I'd like to thank Justin for God-winning the podcast. It says that if any discussion happens on the internet, automatically at some point it's going to go into the subject of Nazis and stuff. And so here we are. I mean, how much more Nazi could you get than the film about, Schindler's List, indeed. Now, here's an interesting thing. Justin, you made the statement that this is a film that people should see. So, in your opinion, Justin, is this to the level where you find that this film is a film that kind of transcends the barriers of cinema and it's something that people need to see as a cultural touchstone that is, regardless of its status as a piece of filmic, for want of a better word, entertainment, that it's something that people should be introduced to just as a work of art, let us even say. Is that your opinion?
I would say it should be in schools, you know, it's like something that it's difficult to classify as such as a film in the same terms.
Yes.
Because the subject matter is bigger, you know, yes, bigger than that.
So it is fair to say, I think, that you have a higher opinion of it than the licensing people at whatever studio make it. And I'm going to guess, although I don't know that it's possible, well, it must have something to do with DreamWorks, but it depends who the distributor is. And that's possibly Universal, because they have been really big gits for quite a while, I've noticed. Now, it's the Universal films that you remember fondly that you cannot find on any streaming service. And so it is with Schindler's List. Schindler's List, you have to go out of your way to watch it. And I have heard from everyone who's ever seen it, oh, brilliant film, very important film, everyone should watch it. I'm not sure I could watch it again.
Yeah.
So there is, to a certain extent, an argument to be made there that it's irresponsible of the distributor to make a barrier to people watching it. Because when I hear that, I'm like, well, I can't. Setting aside the time, it might be important, but then if there's a further barrier, such as not being able to handily get your hands on a copy, then that kind of defeats the whole thing. This is the heart of it. Never came up. With most films, you know, you go, okay, that's not available for me to watch. People have assured me it's good. I should watch it, but it's not come up. I can't get it easily. I'll just leave it. And I actually feel a little bit like, no, I should be able to access this movie somewhere without going too far out of my way. And by the same token, I feel that as it's an experience that most people only want to have once, it should be available on such a basis. You can rent it, and I might even go that far. But I find it interesting that your opinion and experience of this movie, and indeed everyone else's, is the same, that it's an incredibly important even text for history, culture, so on and so forth. And yet, if people haven't seen it, then there is a barrier to entry, a very small one. But it exists, and maybe that's where the argument should be made that this is a film that should be for everybody all the time, regardless. And in fact, it is not at this time in that category, at which point I have nothing further to say, for the barrier to entry was too high for me and my rolls of fat to climb over, so I haven't seen it.
You have something to do today.
So you haven't seen Schindler's List. You also haven't seen Jaws. What do you have against Steven Spielberg exactly, Leo? Is the fact he's Jewish?
No, I've seen Jurassic Park. I enjoyed that. I've seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I like Jurassic Park. It's fine. I think it's slightly overrated. That's all. But I like Indiana Jones. Watch those, you know, blah, 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 blah. I know, but it's Jaws never came up. And that's the thing.
I have to say, it's not something you'd go like, oh, I'll tell you what, what we're going to do tonight, we're going to have a treat, we're going to watch, you know, a film about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
It's not something that you're going to run into, okay?
No.
Just saying, like, it is something that everyone needs to see.
Yes. Well, I'll have to book it in the diary, because, of course, it's impossible tonight, for we're recording this on the day of the most important calendar day of the year. The Eurovision Song Contest is on later. We're getting our cake, we're getting our party food, and we're getting on down with some of the best music that Europe has to offer, for surely they would not
put, and Australia up, apparently,
and
as well,
and Australia as well, which means that if you were interested, Ian, you could stay up and join us, because I'm sure they'll put it on live for you too, being as you're part of
I can really feel the joy emanating from Ian.
I'm busy drinking myself to death tonight, so I can't join you.
Yes, you will be probably asleep. Or it'll be first thing in the morning for you. Or you'll get the results just at waking up time. The actual contest will
How
go
will you get
all
to
the
sleep?
Time that you're asleep. It's like
how
Christmas.
Will you get to sleep? I don't know, Ian. You will have a restless night.
No, Ian won't watch it live till they let Gallifrey enter the Eurovision contest.
Well, you know.
I have to go. Sorry.
Oh, you're going to go now, are you, Justin?
Yes.
All right, then. Off you go.
So I shall see you later.
All right, then. So, Ian, yes, your S.
Well, you know, Leo, plants are nice and robots are cute. Isn't it jolly sad when they die? I am, of course, talking about 1972's Silent Running.
Good Lord.
Yeah, good Lord. Is this, are you taking them back? You want to sit down? Or you want...
I am taking them back. I'm fine. But you carry on.
The story is weak. The eco message is ham-fisted, but the acting, visual effects, and for the child in me, those robots are riveting to watch. It's the future, and Earth is a barren wasteland where we all live on protein pills made from what? I have no idea. Nasty solar science, I suppose. In space, the Fraser Valley Forge carries 6 biodomes containing all the remaining examples of plant life in existence, because building biodomes on Earth would be stupidly easy. Of the 4-man crew, only Bruce Dern, you know, actually only likes being a gardener. The other guy's just there for being a job. So when word comes to destroy the gardens with fricking nukes, Dern rebels, kills his fellow crew members, and flies off to be alone in space with 1 remaining garden and 3 fascinating robots. And it's the robots that really hooked me when I saw this as a kid. They're not cute. They look squat and industrial. But they're played by bilateral amputees. And so through a trick of perspective, you can't really see how there's a man inside them, even though there must be a man inside them. You can't see how they could fit them all in. Answer, they didn't. I think the 3 little silent drones were brilliant and given a childlike attitude. And they are our protagonist's only company for the majority of the film. You will weep when one of them dies outside the ship and cry again when Dern runs over another by accident, crippling it. He teaches the robot mechanics to be gardeners and play poker. He gets to walk about in his favourite garden in his favourite Jesus robe and being all in touch with nature. But then the plants start dying. Why, God, why? Oh, they need sunlight? Well, better put up some lamps then, which is so dumb. Well, they need sunlight, you idiot. Alas, Sir ships are closing in, so he jettisons the remaining garden to space and nukes himself with the crippled robot for company, because, you know, the damaged one would only slow down the able one. Sure, I'm sure I just didn't want to die alone or something. And the film ends with the last robot in the garden tending the plants with a little battered watering can. Isn't it absolutely adorable? And we can only speculate about what this film's actual message is. Eco-terrorists are in the right. People hating plants is wrong. Robots are adorable. I'll give them the last one. Mark Kermode, our perennial reviewer we refer to on this podcast, has frequently named the film as one of his personal favourites in his BBC blog, on more than one occasion stating it as his preference over 2001 A Space Odyssey. So, gardens, cute robots, and a muddled eco-message, I give you 1972's Silent Running.
Well, there's about to be an evolution to the concept of it never coming up. It's not true that this never came up. I remember the opportunity that this had to come up was, you know, here's something that we've also mentioned quite a lot on this show. When the BBC used to run seasons of films, and occasionally, at the time, obviously being the mid-80s, science fiction was a thing where you could run a series of, oh, we're just going to run a grab bag of science fiction movies that we can, there's no thematic. I mean, one week you'd have Invaders from Mars, and the next week you'd have Silent Running, for example, and then they'd put King Kong on as well, and just, they'd run them all as if they were all part of a whole, yeah. And of course, my dad, being a science fiction writer, was all for me as a child understanding science fiction through the medium of cinema and films that he thought were good. And the thing about it was that sometimes in life, when you're a child, you could watch the film that's on BBC Two right now, or there's other things that you might like to watch instead. There was a time when if there were two things on two competing channels that you might want to watch, you had to choose one and there was no way to watch the other one. And usually the science fiction film would be allowed to stand, and my dad would skip, he likes soap operas for some reason, or used to anyway, Coronation Street or EastEnders, even though they clash. Do you really want to watch Silent Running? And I said, I don't know. Why are you asked? Because it's in the science fiction series, so I would have thought this would be a shoo-in. He said, no, it's just a stupid thing about a man on a ship with a bunch of trees. You don't want to watch that, do you? I don't know. It's very boring, he said. Oh, well, maybe I'll skip it and go and play my Legos then. All right, then. And that's how I came not to ever see Silent Running, because my dad has no time for it whatsoever. And I imagine it's probably because my dad is a big fan of science. He loves science. And for some reason, I don't know what it is, he sees Silent Running as being somewhat anti-science. And therefore, it's on his permanent dirty list of films we never talk about. So, yeah. So there we go. So not only have I not seen Silent Running, I have been actively warned off it by my father, who bored me. So there we go.
Well, I suppose, yeah, because he is big into science. He's big on, like, let's genetically modify our food. Why not? This will feed the world. This is a good thing. Of course, the film denounces people eating protein packs and pills. I suppose it strawmans your dad's position slightly by going, in that case, the world shall be a wasteland devoid of plant life. Meaning, how does anything live on Earth then? It's like, I don't know how we could extract protein in a science lab without an organic component somewhere being harvested. So isn't the Earth like an airless rock devoid of even humans now or something? The film itself, its model work, its robots, the portrayal of science, I think, is generally quite good for its post, you know, 2001, early 70s era. That's all very good. In fact, I believe the ship itself was recycled for Battlestar Galactica as one of the ships of the fleet. But yes, the story is just where it's lacking. And the fact it does devolve very quickly down to one man being alone on a spaceship, and he likes his garden and he likes his cute robots. It's the actor's performance, I'm sure, that sustains you through it. And so I'm not going to command you to watch this film, but it was certainly something to me that afterwards you will want to own one of those little robots that go around and do little jobs around your house, because they are simply so adorable and so unique that they're not, you can look at them and it doesn't seem like it's a human shape inside them. And so that makes them quite compelling. And same way I think Daleks are compelling, because they lack human characteristics in their design. So anyway, another film you haven't seen. So I feel doubly blessed today.
I haven't seen Razorback, I haven't seen Schindler's List, I haven't seen Silent Running, so we've hit quite a few films that I haven't really seen much of. Just to complete the picture here, my dad also doesn't like Soylent Green because he says it's stupid, but I think he likes it slightly more. He'll tolerate it more than Silent Running due to the fact that it's just stupid. In fact, he would question the sanity of anyone who, for example, wanted to sit through Zardoz. But he wouldn't actually say, he just said, what the hell is that all about? Whereas yeah. Silent Running, I actually think he's actively took against.
Right, yeah, because it has an eco message, and I think he would just analyze that and go, no, the story is wrong at the fundamental level. Never mind those cute robots.
Well, and I think the other thing about it is as well, it doesn't help a cause to put out a piece of transparently shoddy propaganda. Because, I mean, you know, I think he's generally for the scientific part of ecology. Let's not paint him as someone who's like, I hate trees, let's cut them all down. And he's just saying, you know, if you're going to talk about a biosphere and how an ecology and how it's all getting there, this is not helping anyone. This is like trying to present something that's complete fantasy as if it's some kind of serious reality, rather than people watch Fern Gully, because at least people aren't going to mistake that for something serious. And I think it's that sort of Trojan horse aspect of, you know, be worried about it or all your teeth will fall out and your face will stick like it is what he doesn't like, because it's irresponsible.
I kind of have to agree with him slightly about Soylent Green. The same thing occurred to me when I was watching Cloud Atlas, is that when you start harvesting people for food, I suppose it gets you over the immediate hump of there being too much food and not enough people, but it's an unsustainable model because people require food every day. And so you have a kind of conservation of resources going on here isn't good. He will very quickly be simply starving again.
I think he's more concerned about the fact that it's a sort of overwrought melodrama masquerading as some kind of post-apocalyptic science fiction movie. And I think he's not a big Charlton Heston fan. I think that's what it comes down to. But yes, we're going to leave this week's podcast on a note of people exterminating plants and Jews and pigs and their wives and random people they've been paid to get rid of, and the Martians and there being lots of dead people. It seems that the conflict between order and chaos evident in Pleasantville has infected the whole thing. So I think we probably end with a nice hopeful message about loving something even though it's deeply flawed, and how we can all benefit from such an experience. For I present unto you another film with the unusual step of having Sean Bean survive right through till the end in Silent Hill Revelations. Now, I picked on this one because, one, we kind of talked about Silent Hill, the original one, before, and two, because Silent Hill Revelations is objectively pretty rubbish. But I'm a big sucker for Silent Hill. And then it kind of occurred to me as I was rewatching this. I mean, one of the things that the film gets devastatingly wrong is that in the original Silent Hill, Christoph Gunn looked at the video games and went, well, everything's kind of misty and washed out, and there's a kind of almost monochrome quality to it. We'll stick with that. And then the producers, the studio went, well, we looked at the first one and it's kind of grey and black and we don't like that. So why don't we just put loads of colour into it? Because we're going to shoot in 3D. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, now that doesn't really look much like Silent Hill at all, due to the fact that there's a big saturated colour palette to help your 3D effects go a bit better. I mean, for reals. The thing about it is that what Silent Hill Revelations does, it pulls back the curtain on all the shortcomings of Silent Hill as a concept. And if you can still like it, and I enjoyed the movie, I watched it again, I enjoyed it, I'm not sorry I own a copy. It's a fairly straight, mostly, despite the addition of completely irrelevant Kit Harington, sort of run through of the Silent Hill 3 plot. With the devastating thing that in the film, in the game rather, the character played by Sean Bean dies. So you see him at the beginning go, and if you know the game, you're like, oh dear, it's not going to end well for you, Sean, but then you probably saw that coming. And then in a shock twist, in this version, he survives through to the end. And you're like, what? But yeah, because that's completely subverting that whole thing. So I suppose it is counterculture in a particular way. But then, you know, fans of the series moan about things like, oh, why do you have to put Pyramid Head and everything? And then they go into the big thing of explaining that Pyramid Head was a particular sort of personification of a guilt held by a character in Silent Hill 2, and therefore it is completely inappropriate to have him rock up in all the other stories, where indeed in the games, Pyramid Head does not rock up because he's a Silent Hill 2 thing. God damn it. Wah, wah, call the ambulance. Nerd rage, rage quit. But the thing about it is, right, it's like Freddy Krueger or Jason. Pyramid Head is possibly the most iconic monster in the entire series. So when you're trying to sell it to a mass market, you kind of have to put Pyramid Head in. However much he worked really well in Silent Hill 2, he's kind of a thing, and therefore he has to be worked in. And I have no objection. Watching Pyramid Head in a movie is not a chore, you know, especially when the movie is so badly put together that you could just kind of, oh, this is a cool bit. Oh, I'm enjoying this. Oh, the cool bit's over. Now they've gone into some really ropey dialogue. It suddenly occurs to you, you're like, oh God, this is terrible. It's a morass of half-baked metaphysical pablum that's been regurgitated. None of it makes sense. I mean, you know, it is a homage to Stephen King in the sense that, like some of Stephen King's most half-baked works, they don't actually have any real commitment to what's going on or explaining the quote-unquote mystery. And because at the end of the day, the original concept is, oh well, this dude goes to this town and then all this freaky stuff starts happening with fetus babies and deformed nurses. That's the concept. And then when somebody at the meeting said, but why is that happening, I said, eh, well, make something up. But that's it. And that's more or less exactly, well, there's something to do with a cult and a ritual. And then they go, oh, I read some H.P. Lovecraft one. What about if we had a gigantic dark elder god? Now, why is he particularly interested in a small town in the middle of Virginia? I don't know, he just is. And it's all like that. And the thing about it is, this is no different in the games. The games take longer to play through. And to be honest, they're an atmospheric experience, in at least at the beginning. I haven't got further than number four yet. I do have the others, but I haven't played them yet. But I have heard that they don't get better in quality up to that point. So the whole thing is like, well, yeah, this is Silent Hill. If you were disappointed because they were giving you this, I mean, in fact, possibly the least true to form thing is that the writers of these two movies actually try to come up with some kind of consistent storyline and try and actually write through character arcs and all the stuff they were taught to do in writing college. And you're like, dudes, just forget it. Just really, just walk away. It's not going to happen. But they gamely try, and that's why the film falls flat on its face time and time again, because they're trying to stick close to the source material and simultaneously have it make sense and be about something. Two things which are fundamentally incompatible. Yet with all of this trashing that I've just given it, I love Silent Hill. And I think that Adelaide Clemens, who plays the main character from Silent Hill 3, does a bang up job. And the bit with the bunnies is still good. And the guy who plays the private investigator, he's still good too. And they could have done with more fairground and less motel. And for my money, Kit Harington didn't even need to be in it at all. The wacky cult were fine, but not great. It is clear that the reason, one of the big problems with this movie is that they simply didn't have the budget to do what Silent Hill should do, which is blow your little socks off with some crazy twisted industrial hellscape, which is obviously the point of the games. But in a film which has a budget that's so low, you've got to pick and choose your moments. And so that's what they did. And it is still sad that at the end of the film, the girl gets picked up in a truck by none other than Peter Outerbridge, who is clearly being set up, as this is a Lionsgate release, for a little Canadian release, a la Saw, in the third Silent Hill movie, to be the character from the fifth Silent Hill game. And of course it did that poorly that they decided not to bother using that license, or indeed having a Silent Hill film featuring as the starring character a character played by Peter Outerbridge. That is the real tragedy of this movie, that we didn't get that Peter Outerbridge Silent Hill film. So there we go. Have you even seen either of the Silent Hill movies, Ian?
Okay, yes, I've seen the first Silent Hill movie. I haven't seen the second. We've talked about the first Silent Hill film, I think, in some detail in previous podcasts. I've played the first two games. I've seen the third one played through to the end. I haven't seen any after that, but as far as I understand the reviews, none of them are as good as the first three. It's forever seems trying to get back to its glory days. Everyone keeps going back to it because they remember the glory days. But I, like you, I'm a big fan of this franchise, where the environment itself, I don't think it needs explaining. I think the explanations for what it is sort of naturally occur to you as you experience it. It's an environment that is sort of passive aggressive towards you, and warped and parodied and inhabited by damned souls, of which you are probably going to be one of them. And they have a lovely feeling of isolation and collapsing institutions, especially Silent Hill 3. I remember that maybe you start off in the mall and that's shut down at night and that gets dark and weird. And then you have to kind of leave and go home. You have to go home through like crumbling ruined buildings before you get home and things like that as well. I was completely unaware that the Silent Hill sequel existed at all. It had a budget of $20 million and made $52.3 million. So it didn't make three times back its own money, which is probably why we haven't had a third Silent Hill film. Yeah.
Well, that actually surprises me now that they haven't pushed it forward to the third, because like I said, they lined up Peter Outerbridge, who's a bit of a cult actor. They can make it in Canada. It's a Lionsgate film. I'm wondering if it's just sort of on the back burner. I mean, they've got all this stuff. Lionsgate have got, you know, Sinister, Insidious, all of these, The Purge, all of these other horror franchises, and you know, they've got a slate. Maybe they just decided that Silent Hill can wait until they need, you know, something like that, where the others have died. I didn't realize, because I was trying to look it up last night and I just kind of, you know, got lost. It was late. And I just assumed that it had bombed, but that's not a bomb. That's just good, but not great. Do
yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes. I mean, I think it's Silent Hill is a difficult universe to write in a film universe because, like I say, a lot of its menace is passive. Even the monsters are just kind of gnawing on you because you're walking past them at that particular moment in time. Nothing personal, not chasing you down across the entire map. It's more like there's something around that is emanating evil and you're moving towards it and you're going to confront it and shut it down again. It's kind of menacing and it's the unsettlingness of it all. That's what makes Silent Hill such a beautiful franchise. This is one I might actually try and track down. In fact, I feel like I should track down at least watch on YouTube best bits of the Silent Hill film as well, because it is a franchise I do have a lot of affection for as someone who isn't necessarily a big horror fan, because it's not splatter gore. It's more disgust. And the feeling of doing something wrong and having horrible consequences spring upon you because you did not understand how the environment or the magic worked. The whole kind of your mirror image of yourself starts getting covered in blood and the room itself becomes seething with blood as well and then stops moving because they have died. And it's quite unnerving. It is a beautiful series. It's terribly sad it's gone to a bit of a decline. It's a shame the films have stalled. But Silent Hill, always a favourite.
Well, I think that, well, it's worse than that, Jim, because of course, I mean, one of the things about it is that you have things that have really taken Silent Hill out over time. I mean, in the PS3 generation, it is agreed that the Homecoming guy, Travis Parker, I think his name is. The problem with him was that they'd had, you know, some dude followed by some other dude who was even more mopey than the first dude. And then ironically, what happened was, as we recall, in Silent Hill 3, they had a young teenage girl. And the Silent Hill developers were like, yeah, well, we were kind of sick of doing losers as the main character, so we thought we'd have someone with a little bit. Unfortunately, in a horror movie, having the protagonist be a teenage girl isn't quite such a groundbreaking departure as it is in the series of video games that it came from. So I think there is a certain level to which we go, oh, no, not another thing with a teenage girl protagonist. Oh, well, sigh, there we go. But they make the best of that they can. Now, what's really interesting is that Silent Hill 4 tried something a bit different, and I think it might have got away with it, except for the fact that there were a number of phenomenally poor decisions. First of all, there was a limited space total inventory system with no stacking. So if you've got a health item and then you've got the same health item, then you couldn't stack them into one space on your inventory, which had like 4 spaces or something for you to carry. And then you had a chest which had another 20. So you only had 24 slots. So you end up like throwing things away. But unfortunately, there were certain objects which you got quite early on, which were of no use whatsoever till later in the game. And to get to that part where you needed that item, you had to use other items. And it just became this nightmare of trying to make, you know, optimize. And that's not a fun game. You've got unlimited number of slots, but you have to get from A to B, and you need this object, but you can't use that. Ah, terrible. And then there were enemies you actually physically couldn't kill, that they thought it'd be fun to have a puzzle where you've got a sword that can trap ghosts, but if you take the sword out of the ghost slowly comes back to life, and after a few minutes it starts chasing you again, and there is nothing you can do to get rid of the ghosts, which is like, well, I suppose if they'd really thought that idea through, it might be fun, but in the way that they've done it, it's just annoying. And then they make you do the whole game twice, once by yourself, and then a second time with one of those useless companions who keeps getting into trouble. If she dies, you die. And so basically, it was like Silent Hill 4 is like spooky stuff with an added shitload of frustration. The game. Won't you enjoy playing that and ripping your hair out and screaming and just not with terror, but with just complete anger and rage. So yeah, 4, not the best video game in the world, although it does have some nice. And it also doesn't help. It's a complete tangent off. It doesn't even mostly take place in Silent Hill, and it's a bit weird. But so the nice thing about that is that you could completely skip it. But up until this point, you've had human protagonists. So then in 5, you get this Travis guy, and he's like a trucker with massive muscles, and he can really wield that crowbar. And you're suddenly like, well, I feel less under threat now that I've got, you know, Captain America goes to Silent Hill. That doesn't help. So that's what people whinged about. I'm sure that the rest of the game is perfectly fine. I haven't played it yet. And then in Downpour, they tried to do more of an open world kind of thing where you had like side missions. I'm incredibly fascinated to play this, but because it wasn't about the usual things and because it had this sort of a rain motif and because it was a little bit more, I mean, I get the impression that it was a little bit less actiony and more contemplative. I am absolutely dying to play that game, but a lot of people thought it was just a bit meh. Really. And then, of course, after this, and then they had a few spin-offs on handheld consoles. And now, of course, in the new Bulge generation, they got Guillermo del Toro on board with Hideo Kojima to make the next entry, which they released a playable trailer for. And then Hideo Kojima quit. Guillermo del Toro had other things to do. And so Silent Hill is currently effectively dead. Well done, Konami.
I think this thing's going down at Konami at the moment, I'll be honest with you. Because they, what did they, Metal Gear Solid guy got fired or marginalized?
Hideo Kojima.
Yeah.
So they had the guy who was who made Metal Gear Solid, who's now left. He was going to make the next Silent Hill game with Guillermo del Toro.
I know. That would have been a wet dream. I would have walked to, I might have bought a third generation, fourth generation console or something. Who knows? Stranger things could have happened. And it's terribly sad, but I get the feeling is that the video game branch of the company isn't making a lot of money, especially with Hideo hemorrhaging money just making the next Metal Gear Solid game. And so instead they're gearing the company more towards mobile games and gambling, which is a massive source of revenue for them. So it's a case of money winning over art, I'm afraid. All the same, if I spent $20 million just making a game engine for my product, I too would be going, why are we employing you again?
I think we've actually stumbled through the discussion of this into a conversation about the fact that there are two major properties at this time of Metal Gear Solid and Silent Hill as a video game manufacturer. Those are the ones that they have made money on and that continue to generate some revenue when they appear and are world beaters and all of this kind of thing. But the problem is, like you say, they are what they are because the creators of them have a particular strangeness to them. And that also means that as the best, you know, if they were, Konami were making like a baseball game and an American football game and a racing game, no problems. Brilliant. Fantastic. But what they're making is like the hallmark tactical espionage action with long talky cutscenes thing and the one where a passive aggressive town full of mist and wibblies tries to kill you. And the problem is these are both niche markets. However big they are with the fans, they are not going to pay the massive budgets that are being demanded for them. And therefore, if from a business perspective, we can see exactly what's going on. And it has to be said that as much as I love Silent Hill, I can see the problems with it. There are loads of them. Silent Hill is not, you say it's hard to put in a film, it's hard to put in a game, it's hard to put in a comic book. Silent Hill is an immensely difficult concept, particularly bearing in mind the fact that the minute, you know, in the first one, they kind of went a bit all Dennis Wheatley with their devil worship because they didn't want to go the full Lovecraft. And because there's something mundane about cultists summoning a devil with horns, even if it has got extra eyes. And so at that point, it all kind of starts to fall apart. And Metal Gear Solid, don't even go into it. The jokes about, well, I just went away to, you know, I went and had a 3-course meal and then I came back and then I resumed the game. I didn't press pause. I just let the cutscene play out. You know, these are problematic properties. And unless they're in the hands of people who care about and nourish those properties, yeah, I can see why they're gone. But it doesn't make it not sad.
Yeah, that we've lost. Well, we're still going to get Metal Gear Solid 5 at some point because it's just too far gone to stop now. But yeah, I worry. Will this be the end of this prestige lines of video game series I played when I had a console and have kind of lost contact with?
Well, I can't say much because I've picked everything up secondhand and never even put the discs of the PS3 versions. The only PS3 Silent Hill disc I've put in was the famously derided HD Silent Hill collection, where I think I went with the original voices because I'd heard that they'd done such a terrible mashup of the redone, and also they've taken away certain things which were there, although they were there to mask technical limitations in the hardware at the time. They also provided atmosphere, and because they weren't going to do any more development work on properly HD sets, just stop in the distance, you could see a line, whereas they were covered with mist before, and some idiot went, take the mist away, you don't need it, you've got so much more processing power. Yes, but the draw distance doesn't. No, but it doesn't matter. Just do it. So yeah, with all its flaws, the only Silent Hill game I've played on the PS3 is Silent Hill 2. I guess the fans are living in the past as much as anyone else on this one, because I am one, and that's my confession of Silent Hill shame. So there we go.
Indeed.
But in the end, what we have discovered, therefore, is that sometimes you can love something even though it's deeply flawed. So that's good news. So if people want to tell us what they love that's deeply flawed, where, Ian, might they go to tell us about that kind of confessional?
Well, one place you can go to prevent us for talking about video games during our ABC of Cinema would be our Facebook page, which you can find on Facebook.com/ Revenge of the 80s Kids. And that's 80s as in numbers, 80s. Please go there and like our page. It is our community hub. We put up links to a podcast there, as well as links we find interesting. But podcasts are what it's all about. So point your web browser towards 80s Kids, and that's 80s as in letters. So eighteskids.podomatic.com. Please go there and subscribe to our podcast using the podcast aggregator of your choice, or download to your PC for dark reasons of your own. But this is only where our most recent podcasts can be found. For the legacy of our podcasts, you must go to the 80skids.blogspot.com, where you'll find a full archive of all our shows ever there waiting for you to enjoy at your leisure. Currently standing at, how many episodes isn't there? 199?
I think we're up to like 98 or something, and then we're going to transfer in the next tranche when I make some room on Podomatic.
So there you go, 90 episodes. Surely that should satisfy you. But if this isn't enough for you, you can track down individual 80s kids in such places as...
LeoStableford.com is where you can find my other stuff. And although it's been quiet for a bit, and I've mostly just been pointing people towards the podcast for various podcasty reasons, which will become apparent to regular listeners, in a minute there's going to be all sorts of other stuff on there, which is also curiously to do with the podcast and the status thereof. If you want to have a look at some of Justin's artwork, then you can do so at justinwyatt.deviantart.com. And that's kind of all the news that's fit to print. So we'll be back soon with more film-related gubbins. And, of course, we have two more alphabet shows to go. And one thing I've noticed about these shows is that they throw up curiosities and things that we otherwise wouldn't have talked about, which has made me immensely glad to have done them. And I hope that people at home have had as good an experience of listening to them. Wouldn't you agree, Ian? I don't know.
Yes, I am enjoying my film collection involving mysterious objects buried in the London Underground, dangerous pigs, and cute robots. So, really, I think I've covered all the grounds there.
Yes, you have indeed. And not only that, but you've managed to put out things that I haven't seen, which has been a source of great joy. So, and now I've got to go away, obviously, and watch every film that was ever made, ever, in time for the next alphabet show, so that this embarrassing situation doesn't come up again. So what are you going to do with the rest of your day, Ian?
I don't know. Probably go see to the cat. He's been out and wants some attention.
Yeah, so there we go. And that's why I've seen all the films ever, and Ian has a happy cat. So on that message, we'll send you away. Bye, everyone.
Farewell.